Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Aminata in Brooklyn, wishing The Brian Lehrer Show a happy 25th anniversary. You're listening to 25 years and 25 days in WNYC.
Today, it's 2002.
Remember, with great power comes great responsibility.
When Rudy swore me in, he said to me, "Don't fail our people." Rudy, I will not.
Sin is for every nameless, faceless woman of color that now has a chance because his door tonight has been opened.
Today's legislation imposes annual tests on millions of school children.
States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world.
How many of those 2002 voices and those 2002 stories did you recognize? In 2002, Jimmy Carter won the Nobel Peace Prize. Chicago won Best Picture at the Oscars. Tony for Best Play, The Goat, or Who is Sylvia by Edward Albee. The best album Grammy went to the soundtrack for Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Empire Falls by Richard Russo won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. And books that made it to number one on the New York Times nonfiction bestseller list included Bush at War by Bob Woodward, Let's Roll by Lisa Beamer, Leadership by Rudy Giuliani, and Stupid White Men by Michael Moore. And in 2002, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops barred any priest who had ever abused a child from future ministerial duties.
Every one of us has to earn trust. We are long past the era where certain states of life were automatic passes to trust. And that's across our culture, across our society. It's not just the church.
Bishop Joseph Galante on June 22, 2002, after revelations that a Boston priest named John Geoghegan had been given a job at a church despite being accused of molesting seven boys at his previous parish. But as this AP report told us in 2002, advocates for victims' families were not yet satisfied.
Catholic bishops say even though some abusive priests may be sent to monasteries, the new policy forever bans them from public ministry. Conference President Wilton Gregory says the new policy will
eliminate any loophole that an abuser could try to use.
But victims advocate Barbara Blaine says members of her group are stunned.
It's disappointing that the outcome would still leave perpetrators in the priesthood.
The measure now heads to Pope John Paul II for approval, but there's no timetable for when the Vatican will act.
That AP radio report from 2002. With that new policy, the bishops hoped to quickly put the scandal behind them, but it wasn't over. The Boston Globe won a Pulitzer that year for the paper's coverage of the sex abuse scandal. Michael Paulson, now the national religion reporter for the New York Times, was on that reporting team for the Globe and joins us now to talk about one of the shocking stories of today's generations then and now. Hi, Michael. Thanks very much for coming on WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
Remind us of the Boston Globe story in January of 2002 and what you revealed about that particular priest and how he was handled by the diocese.
Sure. The crisis in Boston really exploded in January of 2002 with a series of stories about the way that the Archdiocese of Boston had handled the case of a priest named John Geoghegan. He had been accused of molesting a large number of children, and there was litigation going on. But the series of stories that the Globe ran was striking because it had a large number of church documents showing that church officials, bishops, other priests were aware that Geoghegan had been accused of molesting kids and had moved him around from parish to parish. And that the church had done the same with multiple other priests. There were really painful letters from women whose sons had been abused, pleading with church officials to make sure that these priests did not have the opportunity to abuse other kids, and then really startled to find that the priests were simply moved to a different parish where they went on to abuse again.
And so let's recall that June 2002 moment, so 5 months after your stories made those revelations, that we played, the moment we played a clip of a moment ago, the announcement by the Conference of Bishops of their new policy. The bishops had resisted a blanket removal of all the priests with child sex abuse in their past, really on that blanket basis. What was the reluctance about, and why did they change in the middle of 2002?
Yeah, the bishops had acknowledged in various ways that abuse was an issue. They had been talking about it for some years. Abuse cases had kind of entered the public limelight as early as the early 1980s in Louisiana, when there was another horrific case involving a priest who had abused a large number of kids and had been shuffled from parish to parish. So there was some attention to this, but the bishops had always held very strongly to this notion that they were essentially autonomous, that they could make decisions within their own diocese, that the national group of bishops didn't have any legal authority over them. And bishops also viewed themselves as quite paternal to priests and as having kind of personal responsibility for helping priests through crises. The attention was always on the priests, not on the victims. And bishops would send priests accused of abuse occasionally to get treatment. It was thought for a while that maybe pedophilia could be treated, which it's now understood that it cannot be. And then they would give them another chance, often with a terrible effect. So what happened in 2002... the Globe stories got a ton of attention. At this point, the internet is widely available, and so there's a global audience for this coverage. And the details that the stories had, particularly not just about what the priests did, but about what the bishops knew, were so shocking that it really angered a lot of people. And Pope John Paul II, who by then was already ailing, knew that he had a significant problem on his hands, he summoned all the American cardinals to come to Rome that spring said that it was time for a purification of the church, spoke in fairly strong language about the problem of abuse. And that led to this gathering that you're referring to in June of 2002 in Dallas, where all the American bishops get together and decide they need to do something different. And they approve a national policy whose key feature is what they called zero tolerance, that any priest who is credibly accused of abusing a minor has to be removed from ministry forever.
I was looking back at some of the media coverage of that conference at the time, and some of it was about debate among the priests because of the Catholic doctrine that redemption is possible, and the pastoral letter from just the year before, which took the position that criminals in general in society should be rehabilitated rather than simply punished. And now they came out with this zero tolerance policy. And I wonder for themselves, and I wonder if that was a major source of debate in 2002, if you recall from your own reporting, or was it just a few who were, you know, what I would say is so dense or defensive that they didn't get it, that this is what you just do with child sex abusers, redemption or not, you stop assigning them to work with kids?
Right. I think by the time the bishops arrive in Dallas that spring, there's a consensus that they have to act. Yes, to protect children, also because they have a major communications and legal problem on their hands. The publicity is enormous and intense, and the reaction from Catholics in the pews is quite angry and upset. So by that point, they need to act. But you're right that there are complexities in the way that the church has traditionally viewed this, and there's been a heavy emphasis on forgiveness and on mercy, and there was a tendency to kind of prioritize these kind of theological notions over what the social sciences were telling them, which is that pedophiles cannot be rehabilitated, and that the only thing to do with guys who have a history of sexually abusing minors is to keep them away from minors, and that has to be permanent. And it clearly took them way too long to get to that point, but that's where they said that they had arrived that spring.
So, Catholic listeners, how much has the pre-sex abuse scandal changed your relationship with the church since 2002, changed it to this day? 212-433-WNYC. Whether you know someone personally involved or are someone personally involved, or not? Did the scandal scare you away from this religion, from any organized religion? Have they finally done what is needed to be done and you got alienated for a while and came back? 212-433-WNYC. I see we have a caller waiting on the line who we'll get to shortly who is preparing now to be a priest and wants to talk about the protocols that are now in place. So any priest in training, in addition to that caller who we will get to, or anybody else who's been a priest for a while and watched this happen over the course of your life and career, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. For our guest who was part of the Boston Globe team in 2002 that did Pulitzer Prize winning coverage revealing the extent of the reassignment of priests with pedophilic pasts into new jobs with children. Michael Paulson, now the religion reporter, national religion reporter for the New York Times. Let's talk to that priest in training calling in. Paul, you're on WNYC in the Bronx. Hello.
Hi, Brian. My name is Paul. I'm a Roman Catholic deacon, and I'm going to be a Roman Catholic priest in May. And I'm a close observer of Roman Catholic environments where there is outreach to children and to families for the last 11 years at least. And I can, as a close observer, say that the protocols are extremely strict, that if, for instance, if there is after-school religious education and someone wants to help as a volunteer there, well, no one can be a volunteer without being certified in a safe environment training, including a background check, before being approved as a volunteer to work even for an hour a week with children. And that goes for ordinary men and women. That goes for religious sisters, religious brothers. That goes for priests. It goes for priests in training. And, for instance, if there is an allegation of abuse against a priest, even before it's known whether the allegation is credible or not, the priest is removed from the premises where he has been assigned in ministry within hours. He's removed from the premises, and he does nothing else until the investigation is complete.
So I don't know how long you've been a deacon or otherwise involved with the running of any church, but is it your sense that some of what you were just describing is new since 2002?
Yes, it is. My parents were close with a priest who, it turns out, had abused many, many people. Boys, girls, women, men. And they, when they found out what he had done, well, they knew him at that time and they didn't know what was going on. They felt sick. They felt betrayed. They felt completely stunned that this could have been going on. And anyone who was not sick, who was not a pedophile, could have countenanced this kind of behavior. The guilt is heavier with those who were reassigning individuals because they were not, in a sense, mentally unstable. They were just wrong and very wrong. So it is something new since 2002. But the point that we need to understand now is that Catholic environments today, Roman Catholic environments, are safer for children than any other environment. The protocols are so strict. And we need to look outwards to other environments where children are coming, where people are caring for children, and see whether those environments are equally safe. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking about athletic groups, athletic teams, about other schools that are not Catholic schools. How strict are the protocols there? What are the protocols for allegations of abuse there? I can tell you that in many public schools, the protocols are not strict.
And these are some of the more recent revelations that have come out. Obviously, Penn State, et cetera, which have been much more recent since 2002 when the focus was really on the Catholic Church in a new kind of way at that time. So, Paul, thank you very much. Good luck to you in your training. And Michael Paulson, national religion reporter for The New York Times, put his call into context in terms of your understanding as a journalist. Are there a lot of new protocols, as he says, Is it now one of the safest environments for children in terms of institutional environments where grown-ups, you know, deal with groups of kids and individual kids? Is there any real way to assess that?
Yeah. I think, Paul, it's great that he called. He made some very important points. It is true that every environment in which there are a large number of kids is vulnerable to people who would prey on kids. And, you know, the most common place where kids are sexually abused is in their own homes. But there's sexual abuse problems in schools and in, you know, all kinds of environments. I don't know of any credible study that weighs the relative risk, but he does point out correctly that the church has made significant progress since 2002 in both attempting to prevent and in responding to abuse. On the prevention side, the screening of candidates for the priesthood is dramatically different. They all go through criminal background checks as well as psychological evaluations, and the church is trying much harder to weed out people who might be potential problems before they even get into a seminary. But then, you know, a lot of the problem that triggered the crisis was how the church responded when it heard that a priest was abusive. And that has also changed quite dramatically. In most cases, the church is now reporting all allegations directly to local law enforcement rather than trying to adjudicate them itself. They are immediately removing priests from ministry while investigations go on, and if they're credible allegations, they're removed from ministry permanently. They are being more direct and forthcoming with parishioners about why a priest was removed. It used to be that they would say there was a problem with alcohol, or the priest needed a rest, or the priest was taking a vacation or a leave. There was no candor about the fact that a priest was abusive, and now that is most often just stated publicly. So a lot has changed, yes.
Edward in Boonton, you're on WNYC. Hello, Edwin.
Hello. I'm calling to talk about just a little bit about my 23 years being in the Diocese of Paterson, acting as a pastoral associate in liturgy and music. Early on, I would say probably about 1994-95, there was a priest who came through our church who was being prosecuted for molesting some boys up in Sussex County. And I was told by my pastor that I could not talk about it. And I guess my angst about it is are the hierarchy of the church on the hook for being prosecuted for protecting priests who were abusers that they knew about and moved them elsewhere and didn't say anything to anyone else? There was there were several cases in our diocese of that, and I don't know if there's a statute of limitations on it, but people promise that they're going to do this or do that as far as the church's policy is concerned. But my own feeling is that until there's jail time for the people who are in charge, that's not going to happen. And I have left the church on that issue solely.
Edwin, thank you for your call. So, Michael Paulson, after your original reporting and that of your colleagues at the Boston Globe in 2002 revealed that Cardinal Law in Boston had known about Father Gagin, moved him to other parishes anyway where there were kids, covered it up, you might say, how much did other church officials, maybe in other parts of the country, get held responsible in the legal sense that the caller is describing for, in effect, covering up a crime?
Yeah, this is the huge remaining issue in the crisis, is the degree to which bishops are or are not held accountable. You know, in Boston, Cardinal Law resigned at the end of 2002 under enormous pressure from the public and also, interestingly, from local priests. By the time he resigned, I believe it was 59 priests in Boston had signed a public letter saying that he needed to go. But, you know, it was a voluntary church decision for him to go. His situation had become untenable, and the criminal authorities, despite considerable public pressure, it was not their assessment that he had committed a legal crime. There have been lots of prosecutors around the country who have looked at this question over whether a failure to protect children, whether a kind of exposing them to risk could be prosecuted. And I'm not aware that anybody has concluded that it could be prosecuted. In most cases, bishops who have resigned have done so because they personally abused someone. And there have been very few who have been held accountable for the conduct of someone they supervised. But in Kansas City, there was a bishop who was convicted of a misdemeanor for failing to report to law enforcement that one of his priests had taken pornographic pictures of young girls. So he was convicted and fined, and now the Vatican is investigating him. The current Pope, Pope Francis, has taken a tougher rhetorical line on this question of whether bishops should be held accountable. He has said that bishops should be held accountable. It's not clear exactly what that means, but as I say, there's a Vatican investigation going on in Kansas City, and there have been a couple instances that you may recall in which globally bishops, there's a start of accountability. There was a Vatican diplomat, an archbishop from Poland, who was allegedly abusing boys, street boys in the Dominican Republic. He's been defrocked and is being tried by the Vatican's criminal justice system itself. And there was a bishop in Paraguay who Pope Francis removed a couple weeks ago for a variety of reasons, but among the criticisms of him was an accusation that he had protected a priest who had been accused of molesting seminarians.
This is our 25 years and 25 days anniversary series here on The Brian Lehrer Show. Today it's 2002, with our peg being the year that the Catholic Church priest child sex abuse scandal really came into view, as broken primarily by the Boston Globe and what was going on in the Boston Diocese at that time. Michael Paulson, our guest, was one of the reporters on that Pulitzer Prize-winning Boston Globe news team. He's now the national religion correspondent for the New York Times, as we're talking about this crisis then and now. And I want to play a recent clip of Pope Francis when he addressed the issue in very direct language in July of this year at a morning homily at the Vatican. Here is 17 seconds of Pope Francis in Spanish.
Ante Dios y su pueblo, expreso mi dolor por los pecados y crímenes graves de abusos sexuales cometidos por el clero contra ustedes. Y humildemente pido perdón.
He said, before God and his people, I express my sorrow for the sins and grave crimes of clerical sexual abuse committed against you, and I humbly ask forgiveness. So, Michael Paulson, I wonder if that was new and different, or is that just a stock line that popes have to include in their boilerplate talk these days? Since we were just talking about the question of criminality, I was struck by the fact that he called them sins and grave crimes of clerical sexual abuse. So was that anything new from Pope Francis, or was that what we've been hearing ever since John Paul II in 2002?
I think John Paul II and Benedict both denounced clergy sexual abuse in fairly sharp terms. Benedict called it filth. But Francis, there's a lot of attention on Francis, partly because he's the new pope, partly because there's a sense that he's charting a kind of new course for the church in some ways, setting a different tone. There was a fair amount of concern about his record on this issue in Argentina. As a priest and bishop there was no record of him having met with abuse victims or having acted particularly strongly on this. So there was a concern about whether he would recognize the import of this issue when he became pope. That clip that you played was connected to the moment when he met for the first time with victims. He met with a half dozen victims at the Vatican, and by all accounts, it was quite moving. moving. He spent quite a bit of time hearing each of their individual stories. He's also set up a commission headed by the new Archbishop of Boston, Cardinal O'Malley, a kind of global panel that includes abuse, at least one abuse victim, that's looking globally at new procedures for the church. And he has said he wants bishops to be held accountable. So he has indicated that he intends to take a tougher line on this, and time will tell.
And in that same mass, in fact, in the very next breath, the Pope apologized again. Here's more of his plain language in Spanish. Oh, okay. Nope, we don't have that clip. Let's take another call. Father Lash in Morris Township. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Good morning, Brian, faithful listener.
Thank you.
There's really no way I can do justice to this topic in a short space of time. I'd love to be with you some other time, but on your show. I was an advocate for victims of clergy abuse. I was in a parish, I don't want to name the parish, where previous pastor had abused at least 18 that we were aware of in that parish. I went public, you can Google my name. It's all over the place. My concern is that the Dallas Charter covers only minors. What happens when the priest has groomed a minor until the minor becomes 18 and then sexually abuses him? Unfortunately, that victim is treated like a rape victim, a woman who are assumed to be complicit. I know that for a fact because that has happened in a case that I was working on. So that's a whole other area that has yet to be dealt with. I suppose there are all sorts of legal complications, too, in terms of prosecuting that. The victim has to be willing to go public and so forth. So it's a very it's still a complicated issue. I'm pleased. I love the conversation that I've heard so far. I was called by the New York Times reporter who was covering the Maverick priest. That was a very unfortunate term because at that time a Maverick priest was abusing young boys. So anyway, that's my concern. And I'm pleased with the Pope's response, but it's still not concrete enough for me.
Father Lash, thank you very much. And now we're going to hear another person with a concern, an elected official, New York State Senator Brad Hoylman, calling in. Senator Hoylman, hi, you're on WNYC.
Hey, Brian, thanks for having me.
What's your connection to this issue?
Well, my concern is that I sponsored legislation up in Albany that would eliminate the statute of limitation on reporting criminal charges of sexual assault and erasing the current 5-year limitation on reporting an incident after a victim turns 18. That's very important legislation that's passed in states like Massachusetts, but with all of the apologies from the Catholic Church is being blocked by the Catholic League lobby in the legislature.
And what would change if your legislation passes?
If our legislation passes, then that will mean that we can expose more of these assaults and will bring what I think to be justice to hundreds of individuals, perhaps, in New York State.
Thank you very much for calling in, Senator Hoylman. And a last word from you, Michael Paulson. What does the future of this story hold 12 years after you broke these stories in 2002?
Well, look, Senator Hoylman raises one issue. There's still in many states debate over whether long-ago victims should be able to come forward, and there are all kinds of complicated legal questions there. But I think looking to the future, all eyes are on Pope Francis and the question of whether he is going to actually hold bishops accountable for failure to remove abusive priests from ministry.
Michael Paulson, now the national religion reporter for the New York Times. Thank you so much for joining us today to talk about then and now.
Thank you.
25 years and 25 days continues tomorrow with 2003, the year of the blackout. We wrap up today's installment with the Billboard number one song from 2002. It's Nickelback, How You Remind Me.
Never made it as a wise man. I couldn't cut it as a poor man stealing. Tired of living like a blind man.
sick aside without a sense of feeling, and this is how you remind me.